How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me,
the genes of you and me,
we're all made of DNA.
We're all made of the same chemical DNA.
Hi, you're listening to DNA Today, a multi-award-winning podcast and radio show where we discover new advances in the world of genetics. From genetic technology like CRISPR to rare diseases to new research, for over a decade, DNA Today has brought you the voices of leaders in genetics in over 200 episodes. For the past 3 years, DNA Today has won the People's Choice Best Science and Medicine Podcast Award. I'm Kira Dineen. I'm a certified genetic counselor and your host.
I'm Desiah Phillips, a genetic counseling student at Sarah Lawrence College, and I've had the opportunity to intern with Kira over the past few weeks and work alongside her to create this episode of DNA Today. Thanks so much for this opportunity, Kira, and I'm really excited to discuss this episode topic. So in this episode of DNA Today, we are thrilled to welcome guest Blair Stevens, a certified genetic counselor and director of prenatal genetic counseling services at McGovern Medical School at UT Health Houston. She's also a prenatal genetics media expert for the National Society of Genetic Counselors. Blair joins us today and in this discussion to shed light on the clinical utility of ancestry and its use in reproductive genetic counseling services. So thanks so much for joining us today. We're really excited to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
And before we get started on the interview, we'd like to introduce some terms to help foster inclusivity. We understand that not everyone who is pregnant identifies as a woman or even as a mother. Therefore, we use gender-neutral language like pregnant person or expectant parent, as well as egg donor, sperm donor, or genetic contributor to be inclusive of all identities and methods of conception. We recognize the importance of acknowledging and validating the unique experiences of each individual's pregnancy journey, and we understand that there are terms beyond those that we have mentioned today. Historically, why have we asked patients for their genetic ancestry? How did it tailor their screening or testing and risk assessments that we offered?
Yeah, I really love this question because it gave me the opportunity to look back on my own career and how things used to be done, but even go even many steps before that and do a little bit of research to see, you know, how did we even get here? Because as I'm sure, Desiah, in your training right now, thinking about only offering like one certain test to a certain ethnic or racial group or ancestry group just feels like almost a little cringe. And it makes you like wonder, like, why did we do that? And so carrier screening has been around since the 70s, but I found this really fascinating article from 1990 that kind of focused on the controversies of general population screening for cystic fibrosis, because cystic fibrosis was really the first condition that we said, well, maybe we should screen everyone for it. Prior to that, you know, in the 70s, we started talking about sickle cell trait in African-American individuals, Tay-Sachs and Jewish individuals. But in 1990, I guess that's when they first started saying, like, maybe this should be a, you know, general population thing. And it was really fascinating because a lot of the issues that we are still dealing with today are things that they highlighted. But what I think is really important to know is, obviously, we've learned a lot, but one of the major limitations back then and why we kind of focused certain tests on certain groups was because Delta F508 was really like the only thing that we were looking for. And if you look at essentially non-white populations, the detection rate was less than 50%. And I found the cost. I was like, how much would this cost to have a less than 50% sensitive test? And it was $100 to $200 back then, which is almost $500 nowadays. So if from an economic standpoint, you put out this test that had less than 50% accuracy in your group and you paid $500 for it, I don't think anyone would say that sounds like a good idea. So due to our lack of knowledge of all the variants that we know about today, for example, with cystic fibrosis, due to the immense cost of genetic testing, it just didn't make a lot of sense to say, let's just test everyone for everything. So we just kind of went with what we knew at the time, which was that, okay, hemoglobinopathies are more common in this population. We know that cystic fibrosis is more common in this population. So that just focused the time and energy and monetary resources to the folks that are at the highest risk of having that condition. So it made sense before. And because of those same things, it made sense with post-test counseling. So if I'm a person that has a condition that's more common in my ancestry, then the detection rate should be higher and I should have a lower residual risk. But if, you know, my partner's from an underrepresented group, then their residual risk after a negative screen is going to be, you know, not so reassuring. So because our test was really focused on genotyping select variants that we probably know in the most commonly affected group, you know, we had to kind of use those residual risk numbers based on ancestry. So it wasn't perfect. We've come a long way, thank goodness, but it did make sense with the limitations of technology and cost and just our knowledge of variants within all these genes. So it was really interesting to look back, though. Right.
No, that is interesting to know. And to the price comparison is quite significant. Okay, so fast forward to today, are there specific challenges or advantages when using ancestry data and genetic counseling, especially in diverse populations? And feel free to include any examples in that as well.
Okay, great. I don't use ancestry information nearly as much today in my career versus when, you know, I first started prenatal genetic counseling, which is great because it's certainly a more equitable way to practice and do genetic counseling and testing. And so because most in carrier screening really is the primary place that ancestry comes into play, you know, with things like Down syndrome and chromosome conditions and other genetic syndromes that happen, what we call de novo, meaning spontaneously, there's really not, you know, a group that those things happen more to or less to. So carrier screening is really where we're focusing on. And now that we offer the same panel to everyone, because with the introduction of sequencing, meaning we're looking at the entire gene essentially instead of just parts of the gene, and with the knowledge of there's carriers for pretty much everything in every population, probably because people don't know their ancestry quite as well as maybe they think they do. And so when we started realizing that anyone can be a carrier of cystic fibrosis, anyone can be a carrier of Tay-Sachs or any of these other recessive conditions, we started just saying, okay, the same panel for everyone, whether that's a panel of a few conditions or hundreds of conditions, we really shouldn't be basing it off what their ancestry or ethnicity is. Having said that, if someone told me, I really don't want to do a huge panel, I feel overwhelmed with too much information, but they say that they're from a particular ethnicity where like Ashkenazi Jewish populations, just doing kind of those core few might not be sufficient to really focus on conditions we really do know are more common in Ashkenazi Jewish populations. But for the most part, I say, hey, if you want information, like get this big panel, and it's the same panel that I would offer anyone that walked through my door. So I think it's really much easier to offer carrier screening because it's just one size fits all, essentially, in terms of, you know, you don't have to worry about ancestry, which is also really reassuring because, as I mentioned a second ago, I really don't think people know their ancestry. And I think people use things like race and ethnicity as a proxy, and we know that that's really not accurate, but it's sometimes all people know.
It can be really tough for patients to even really understand the information, like to answer the question.
Yeah, so. Exactly.
In your experience as a genetic counselor, how do you ask patients about their ancestry and like what phrasing do you use to be inclusive and accurate?
Yeah, and this is something that's really changed, especially like just in the last few years. And so we use in our clinics a family history form when patients check in. They fill out things about what might be running in their family, questions they might have for the genetic counselor, but we also ask about their ancestry, their preferred pronouns, any preferred name that's not their legal name. So all of that kind of gets handed to us. So it's a nice little head start so we can see, you know, either what their ancestry is or what they identify as. So it takes kind of the verbiage out of it, but there are times when they don't fill it out or when it's an add-on. And honestly, I don't usually ask unless it's relevant to like what I'm talking to them about. So if there's an add-on because a baby has a heart defect, like I don't really care like what their ancestry is. And so I don't ask about it because it doesn't impact what tests I offer them. So much so that we actually, as a group of genetic counselors, we decided what goes on our family history form. We had the conversation of like, well, should we be asking it at all? Like, why are we asking it if it doesn't matter for so many things nowadays? And there was really two reasons that we decided to keep it on our family history forms and to ask it when we do feel like it was relevant. And one is because we do a lot of clinical research and we want to make sure that our publications show that it's representative of a really diverse population, because so much research, especially back in the day, was from very, very homogenous groups that don't really reflect the general population, especially in the United States. So we have a super diverse population in Houston. So we want to kind of show off that our data is kind of generalizable. But then the other thing is, you know, race is a really more of a social construct that has been rooted with, you know, more bias and discrimination and racism. And I do think that by pretending that race doesn't matter with genetic testing, we're kind of losing the fact that it does matter with many social determinants of health. And by just pretending that it doesn't matter at all makes us maybe lose opportunities to help ameliorate some of those healthcare disparities. So we keep it on our paperwork. We track it in our databases of like our patient data, but we don't necessarily ask about it. But when I do, to get to your question finally, when I do have to ask patients about it or on our family history form, the way we ask about it is, do you know where like your family ancestry traces back to? And if they're not sure and we have to use like race as a proxy or ethnicity as a proxy, we might say like, well, do you identify as, you know, Black, or do you identify as Hispanic, or do, you know, so we try and use race and ethnicity when, you know, people just don't know what their ancestry is.
That's so interesting, Blair, because I've been struggling with that too, being a prenatal genetic counselor. Like, you know, when students rotate in my prenatal, not my clinic, but where I work, you know, I have them ask, but I'm like, you know, do we really need to be? And I'm like, I was wondering, like, as I was, you know, we were planning this episode with you, Blair, I'm like, I wonder if I'm going to change things after this, of like, right? If you'll convince me one way or another. But the way that I'm currently asking is, you know, very similar to what you're saying. And I kind of end up saying, do you know what countries your ancestors are from? Because sometimes people will say, oh, well, yes, I know. And then they'll say something like, you know, really generic, or they just say, oh, I'm from America, or like my ancestors are from America. And you're like, okay, like odds are it's probably not all the way back to America. Like, did your family immigrate from Canada, Europe, like where in the world kind of thing? And a lot of people just, you know, for my patient population, a lot of people end up saying European, of like some kind of mix, but definitely can differ. So interesting that the genetic counselors you worked with, you've talked about like, should we keep asking this? And I wonder if you'll come back to that and be like, maybe you won't in a few years from now. I don't know.
Well, and sometimes it can be difficult with the ancestry question because, you know, when I first started my career, I'm not from Texas, but I've essentially only practiced in Texas. And so when you say like, what country are your ancestors from? Some people would say Texas. And I'm like, no, like before Texas. And there's plenty of indigenous people that were from, like, you know, Texas wasn't always in the United States. And so if they were like an Hispanic person I'm talking to, they actually could have been from Texas, like their ancestors. Or when you ask, you know, a person who's Black, like, where'd your ancestors come from? Like, I don't know. Like, my ancestors were slaves that were brought here. And so I really don't know what country. Like, so it feels sometimes insensitive to ask, because like, I clearly don't know that information. So I do think it takes, you know, nuance and tailoring when you're looking at either at the paperwork or when you're looking at your patient, but you also don't want to shy away from it if it is important. But that's when we started saying like, is it important? Or even in our notes, we used to say Miss So-and-so is a G1P0, you know, Hispanic female. Like, why do we put that in our note when it's not a part of a risk assessment? When it is, it makes sense. So it's been a really rich conversation with our group, and we don't want to lose it because it can be important, but we also don't want to use it in a way that stigmatizes or unnecessarily, you know, brings any sort of negativity towards documentation or towards a session or to a patient.
And like you mentioned, some people don't know their ancestry due to adoption or having a estranged family and so on. So is it detrimental to not know your ancestry?
It can be, certainly. When I think of, you know, should I be getting earlier mammograms because of my family history of early onset breast cancer, or kind of more adult onset things that maybe the patient themselves wouldn't have had time to personally manifest yet, it certainly can be detrimental not to know what your older relatives have experienced health-wise. From in the prenatal realm, I always tell, you know, my family or my patients who are adopted, for example, like, we know that you're healthy. And so that gives us a lot of reassurance that, like, most likely your baby won't have something inherited that we would diagnose in childhood. But having said that, you know, if I had a family that has had a couple of miscarriages, I'm usually pretty reassuring that it's probably not like an inherited translocation or chromosome rearrangement. But if I had known that, well, my mom, she had 3 miscarriages and my aunt had 2 miscarriages and a baby that died because of lots of birth defects, like, that would certainly raise more red flags. So it can be detrimental in that sense, but fortunately we would once again offer the same expanded carrier screening panel and the same non-invasive prenatal testing, you know, screen to pretty much any pregnant person. So I don't think in prenatal it makes as much of a difference as it does, like, managing more adult healthcare.
And in the preconception and prenatal spaces, when ordering carrier screening, it's recommended to include a patient's genetic ancestry. How does this information help to calculate more accurate risk statistics, like residual risk, for example?
So this is definitely a moving target question, and it's evolved, you know, certainly over my career. I remember at one point they were asking the patient's ancestry because if they, let's say they came back positive for something, they were assuming the partner, the reproductive partner, had the same ancestry, and they kind of gave you a reproductive risk using that assumption. And I mean, I can see how they're trying to be helpful, but clearly that's very problematic, especially as there's increasingly numbers of multiracial couples. And so they used to use it from a risk assessment. There's debate, and it's recently been acknowledged in guidelines that we probably really shouldn't be using residual risk on reports anymore for carrier screening, because in this day and age of sequencing, the residual risk is essentially less than 1%. And maybe it's a difference of 4,000 residual risk versus 1 in 2,000 residual risk from this group to that group. So I don't think it's actually required by most labs very often anymore. However, I have heard, and I would certainly want someone to confirm this on the insurance side, but I have heard that if you mark Ashkenazi Jewish, that there are maybe different CPT codes or different insurance implications, which is probably just more dated, kind of grandfathered in policies. Because expanded carrier screening is so widespread now. But so there might be some benefit if you're Ashkenazi Jewish because of billing and insurance. But other than that, I don't think it really makes much of a difference anymore. Outside of a couple of examples, like with SMA and maybe some like alpha thalassemia examples, but for the most part, I don't think it really matters.
And I did have a follow-up question about SMA and alpha thalassemia. I was just wondering if you could expand a little bit more on how ancestry information can be used to assess the likelihood of being a carrier for conditions like those.
Yeah, so carrier screening, I used to talk to all my students, like, with carrier screening, you don't have false positives. It's just you find, like, if you're a Delta F508 carrier, you're a Delta F508 cystic fibrosis carrier, and there's really no false positives. That's changed. Nowadays, well, first of all, I guess you could be a likely pathogenic carrier. So those could always be downgraded. So you could essentially have a false positive on a typical carrier screen result. But for those listeners who are unfamiliar, spinal muscular atrophy is challenging, to say the least, because there's a pseudogene that makes it really hard for the laboratories to tell how many copies of the gene they have on which chromosome. So there are some people that have just one copy and they're definitely a carrier. And there are some people that have 2 copies of the gene, but it's on the same chromosome. And so their other chromosome has 0. And if they pass that on, then they've passed on that trait to their pregnancy. So people, you know, much smarter than I got together and they found out that there is this marker, what we call a SNP, that's associated with those types of carriers that we call 2+0. And so in order to increase the detection rate and to not miss those carriers as much, if you have the SNP, even though you have 2 copies of the gene on your result, they say that you're at increased risk. So now we have a screening test for carrier screening, meaning when you screen positive, it doesn't mean you're a carrier. It means that you might be a carrier, which is very novel and not typical for the vast majority of, or I can't think of actually any other genetic conditions that we screen for in carrier screening. The problem with the SNP is that it's a really effective marker if you're from certain ancestries. So Jewish individuals, if you have that SNP and you have 2 copies of the gene, we can pretty much tell you that you're a 2+0 carrier and that your partner should definitely be screened. But like in my population, I have a very large Hispanic population, and the chances are not very high that you're a carrier at all when you carry that SNP in an Hispanic population. And so we use ancestry to kind of tell you how likely you actually are to be a carrier of SMA. But for example, I had a patient who, she was of Pakistani ancestry, and she had a positive, and Asians are more likely to be carrier versus Hispanic or Black or white. But she asked, you know, well, what do you mean Asian? Like Eastern Asian, South Pacific Asian? And I scoured, and I even like reached out to the labs to say, what do we mean by Asian? Because it's such an immensely heterogeneous group. And I couldn't find the answer. And so I don't even know if that result really, or that risk assessment really applied to her. And Hispanic, I mean, I mentioned them, like Hispanic populations are incredibly diverse. You know, we have a lot of indigenous populations. We have plenty of Northern European. We have African populations. So it's fraught with limitations, but it is a way to kind of help patients understand that SNP. I personally dislike it, but I understand why it exists. So I don't think it should ever alter someone's care. I can see how it can alter maybe information that patients are given in terms of maybe anticipatory guidance or, you know, for example, if I have a patient who is tested positive on a carrier screen for something that their partner is extraordinarily unlikely to be a carrier of based on his or her ancestry, you know, genetic testing isn't free, and there's a lot of limitations to like trying to get the partners tested sometimes. And so if they have an incredibly low chance of being a carrier or something, I can understand why sometimes that risk information might lead to the patient deciding not to want testing. But I don't think that someone's ancestry or race should dictate what I offer them per se. But it is used, for example, alloimmunization is, you know, the red blood cell antigen typing. We do know that certain races are much more commonly expressing certain antigens on the red blood cell. So if I have an antibody against a certain antigen and my partner's of a certain, you know, ancestry, it might be very, very unlikely that, you know, he would have that or she would have that type. So it's used a little bit with alloimmunization. There's a lot of maternal morbidity and mortality is not great in Texas. And so when we know that a lot of people that have worse outcomes are like Black women and Black pregnant people. And so there are certain things that we know, like comorbidities, like high blood pressure and gestational diabetes, that are more common in certain races or in certain ancestry populations. But I don't think it has much to do with the genetics. I think it has more to do with those social determinants of health. So I don't think that they should be treated differently because they are this. I think their whole care should be treated differently because they are not getting the same equitable care that a lot of non-Black people are getting. So once again, I don't think it really should change how we're doing things. I should just think it should be paid attention to so that we can try and fix some of those inequities that are a result of race, for example.
Such a good thing to think about, and it makes a lot of sense that you wouldn't alter someone's care just because of their ancestry. What about in other areas of healthcare aside from preconception or pregnancy?
So I know a little bit like pharmacogenetics. They look at different, you know, races that are more attached to certain genotypes or different molecularly based things that can help figure out which medicines are better or worse. There's certainly, you know, more genetic variants with like certain cancer syndromes that are more likely to be in one group or another. And I have only practiced prenatal my entire career, so don't ask me any follow-up questions about cancer, please. But, you know, I've heard that there's a lot of people that might just get, you know, tested for Ashkenazi Jewish mutations and they might miss something in a more expanded panel. So once again, I feel like it might help us, you know, dictate that we're more likely to be a carrier of this or that, but it doesn't mean that they won't necessarily benefit from the more expansive panel that you would offer someone that wasn't in that ethnicity or ancestry group. But honestly, I'm not even sure like how other fields of medicine are even using it. And if they are, I would question like, is that really beneficial or is it just something that's kind of more outdated and a source of probably plenty of bias that maybe has gone unrecognized or should be examined further.
And thank you for commenting on that question. I know it goes a little bit outside of what you know and kind of what you're comfortable with. What are the, or any ethical considerations involved in using ancestry data for clinical purposes? Like, what should healthcare providers be sensitive to?
I definitely think, as I was talking about before, it's really important to capture that information. I have had patients, I mean, maybe one or maybe two that I can think of in my career that have kind of circled the ancestry question or the race or ethnicity, however we termed it in the past, and said, like, why do you need this? And so I think for certain populations, there's a very legitimate reason for distrust with the medical system of, you know, why are you using this and are you going to use this against me? And then I think there's, you know, certain people of certain political beliefs that feel like, you know, there's reverse racism and that there's like, I'm not going to talk about race because it's talked about too much. And so there's a lot of people I think that have problems with this subject in question. And so I think it's really important for us to empathize with why they might have those feelings and make sure that we build trust and build rapport so that they know that we're using it in a way that's beneficial to them. And, you know, kind of like we've been doing on this whole discussion of questioning, like, well, is it beneficial? Or like, you know, is it something that I've just done because my, you know, predecessors did it and they did it before them and they did it before them? So I think understanding kind of the history, especially with, you know, racial discrimination and some very heinous things that have been done to certain populations in the past should be in the back of our minds as we're tackling subjects or making decisions about forms and making decisions about how we ask about things. So, and then when we're reporting things, I think we need to do it in, you know, a really conscientious way of making sure that our bias or, you know, bias of other people's isn't creeping in and we're making assumptions about what that data means or exploring other reasons why, you know, we might find certain conclusions with when it comes to ancestry or race.
And where do you see the role of ancestry data heading in the future of genetic research and clinical practice?
I just think it's going to become, you know, decreasingly relevant. So the more we get into the age of precision medicine, where we're actually using the molecular data like regarding a particular gene versus the ancestry, race, or ethnicity, or whatever that's tied to that molecular data. I just think we're not going to need that anymore. I think it's still going to be very important, like I said, for like more of the social determinants of health. But, you know, if I used to test someone that was Black for sickle cell trait, if I can just do precision medicine and like look for the things that are associated with the sickle cell, like why would I care about the person's ancestry? So I don't think at this point we're doing genome sequencing on everyone. So we don't have every, you know, genetic variant that we would need to skip the ancestry question. But I think eventually we can just kind of skip that and either test everyone for everything, period, not just in carrier screening, but genome sequencing wise, or just skip right to the important things that we're looking for without having to triage who to test what for based off of some association that used to be like a shortcut. Because that's essentially, as I say it out loud, that's essentially what using ancestry or race is a shortcut to the test that's most likely to give me the answer I'm looking for. And if you just, you know, use precision medicine in a different way, that's way more accurate than using that shortcut, then I think that's where we're going eventually.
Yeah, I completely agree with that, Blair. I think we're not going to end up using this too much in the clinic. I think on the flip side, in research, it's more important because, you know, to call back what you mentioned, that a lot of our genetic research, especially in, you know, the early sequencing days, most of that data was coming from people of European ancestry. So I think it's more important in the research sense to make sure that we're having like the Pan Genome Project and other really big projects where we have a very diverse set of participants in research to make sure that we are getting that data so that we're not going to have the issues like we used to have that you said at the very beginning of the detection rate is only 50% for someone of this genetic ancestry of saying, okay, well now we're up to 99, just like we are with maybe someone that has European ancestry. So we'll kind of, I think, hopefully as we're doing better and better with diversity and research, then we won't have those disparities in the clinic because it all kind of starts with the research and then it kind of trickles down from there.
Exactly. And one example that I was thinking of, you know, very early on in the discussion was kind of the same thing with like AMA and Down syndrome screening and testing. Like back in the day, we literally only offered amniocentesis to pregnant people 35 and older. And that was that. And then it became, well, now we have these blood tests and now NIPT is available. And we used to only offer NIPT to people 35 and older, but then they did more research and they found, you know, this test isn't bad. And like, just because you're not 35 doesn't mean you can't have a pregnancy with Down syndrome. So with, you know, less expensive testing and with more research and more data that shows that everyone can benefit from this, and really things do start expanding and evolving. But Kira, you bring up an excellent point of like, this information's not going to be useful for all populations until we get more data on the underrepresented populations.
And unfortunately, a lot of it comes back to money. I feel like we're tying everything back to like your first answer, which is beautiful. It's like we've come full circle here. But that one of the main reasons we weren't doing expanded carrier screening panels on everybody, which is a debated term if we should be using expanded carrier screening panels. So I remember you saying that in a presentation in the past, or one of your co-presenters did. But that cost was a huge part. If it, you know, with inflation and everything, cost $500 to do one single variant in the CFTR gene for cystic fibrosis, I can't imagine what, you know, 176 conditions would be or 500 conditions would be. We probably didn't even know the genes of all those back in the 90s. So it's money and research has helped us come a long way with that, because, I mean, it would have cost thousands of dollars for people to do the testing that we do today that, you know, cash price, it's not really what the real price is because the labs are eating some of the costs, but it is a couple $100s, right? So it's right. Like it's feasible now. And the same with NIPS as you're bringing up and everything. So as things get cheaper, then it's like, oh, now there's more, what is it? Like it's more, there's more equity there in terms of just it being more even, I guess.
And I think, you know, cost was a major inhibitor before. And I think that was probably the number one inhibitor. I mean, because it trumped our lack of knowledge. And now I think, I mean, cost is still a concern, and accessible genetic testing because of high cost is still a huge concern. Don't get me wrong. But now I feel like it's our lack of knowledge is a bigger concern, because we can't interpret everything that we have the money to find. And we also don't have as much data as we need and we should have on these underrepresented groups. But because of all of the missteps and all of the terrible things that have happened in the past, like it's really understandable why a lot of underrepresented groups don't want to participate in research or have, you know, take pause before wanting to participate in research. So I feel like cost and the knowledge was our issues before, and now it's knowledge and then cost, which is exciting because I feel like, you know, knowledge is something we can learn over time, and hopefully we can get buy-in from many groups to help with that.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Blair. I learned so much from this conversation, and it really helps to clarify some of the topics I've discussed within my classes. So thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. I had a great time.
I learned so much too. Thank you.
I did want to add that now we're offering increasingly comprehensive and sometimes complex tests like the expanded carrier screening to everyone, it can quickly become overwhelming for patients. So if you're interested in guidance through the Odyssey of genetic testing, or if your patients need help, I highly recommend finding your local genetic counselor at aboutgeneticcounselors.org.
For more information about today's episode, visit dnatoday.com, where you can also stream all 200 plus episodes of the show, including video versions of interviews recorded in 2021 or later. Any questions, episode ideas, guest pitches, or sponsor inquiries can be sent into info@dnatoday.com. Be sure to follow us on social media, especially so you don't miss a giveaway. We are at DNA Today Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, and more. Please rate and review the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. This truly helps us climb the charts and allow more genetic nerds like yourself to find the show. Here's a bonus. If you do and send us a screenshot, I'll give you a shout out on the show. DNA Today is created, hosted, and produced by myself, Kira Dineen. Our team includes communications lead, Corinne Merlino, video lead, Amanda Andrioli, outreach intern, Sonia Tanaker, social media intern, Kajal Patel, and graphic designer, Ashlyn Anokian. Thanks for listening, and join us next time to discover new advances in the world of genetics.
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA. We're all
all made.